We're going to come out of our break and go to item six, education session from Veris on risk parity. Kim?
I'm just going to introduce this topic really quickly and then turn it over to the folks from Veris. Ed Hoffman and Ian Toner are here to discuss risk parity. Risk parity is a strategy that is an asset allocation strategy that seeks equal contributions to risk from various asset classes. So in doing so involves a couple of unique features, including futures and implied leverage and implicit leverage, that sort of thing. So before we go down the path of hearing recommendations around risk parity, I know this conversation's been going on the board for 2 years now, and we're close to making a recommendation about how to fund it. But before we get to that one, we wanted to have a final education session, and today is education only, so nothing's on the table today. Ask all your questions. An education session about, you know, a review of what risk parity is, how we use the leverage. What, you know, I think whenever we start to talk about leverage, the trustees rightly raise some concerns. We want to talk about what leverage means in this instance. And I think importantly, we want to talk about how we see this being a contributor to the total fund results, and, you know, provide you a forum to ask any questions you want. And so in addition to Ed, Ian Toner is here. Ian is the Chief Investment Officer for Veris. And so I've been told he's also the risk parity guru for Veris. So we have the think tank and the brain trust in the room for you to ask any questions you want. With that, I'm going to turn it over to these gentlemen.
Great. Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Tim basically did everything I was hoping to do, so excellent. Thank you. If we take a look at the book, turning to page two, we have the table of contents, and as usual, we're kind of using that as our agenda for this conversation, so we'll hit a quick executive summary and an overview of risk parity. Just get us all on the same page again. Won't spend a lot of time there, but just a refamiliarization. Leverage and futures was the one key topic, I think, that came up in the past, and appropriately so, because leverage and futures, both those terms have been things that have been prohibited from a lot of investment policy statements of institutional investors for a long time. Now we're saying, hey, this actually makes sense, it's worthy of your consideration, and we want to explain why and make sure you're all comfortable with that. If you're not, then we won't. But we want to just walk through the logic behind that. The scenario analysis is designed to show when this strategy type does not do well. So nothing is a silver bullet in the investment management world. We look for attractive risk-return characteristics that also have nice correlation characteristics with the rest of the portfolio, so that when we integrate them, we can diversify our sources of return, knowing that none of them are going to, you know, we won't have all of them hitting it out of the park at the same time, but by the same token, hopefully they won't all be losing at the same time. So we want to get that diversification. And then a little bit on next steps, depending really on how this conversation goes today. So as Tim mentioned, please feel free to ask any and all questions. Let's get it out on the table. And if we don't have the answer, we'll follow up and we'll go from there. If we turn a couple pages into the executive summary then, we note that this is really driven by the asset allocation work that we've done with you to show that a 5% allocation to risk parity helps the overall plan in terms of the risk return characteristics. So that's why it's being discussed, and it falls into the growth sub-portfolio, which we mentioned last time. We originally thought of this as an interesting component for the diversifying sub-portfolio. As we got to know it more, we said, yeah, really interesting things here, but probably a better home is in the growth portfolio. So we made that transition last time. So that's where it lives in terms of the FFP design. And then just highlighting some of those issues about leverage and futures and scenarios. So that's our outline for the approach. If that makes sense with everyone, I'll turn it over to you, and we'll get into page six for the risk parity overview.
Thank you, Ed. And thank you all for your time. Excuse me. Thank you all for your time. If we turn to page six, this summarizes the basic proposition. The basic proposition is that you are building a portfolio when you're using risk parity that gives you exposure to a bunch of different assets, but you recognize the fact that those assets have different risk levels. And so rather than being concerned about the capital you allocate to each asset, you say, if all assets over the long term are compensated roughly at about the same rate per unit of risk, which should work out over the long term, then you want the same amount of risk associated with each asset. Equity gives you upside participation when things are going well. Fixed income gives you downside protection in periods of weaker growth. And you have commodities and inflation-linked bonds giving you protection in inflationary environments. And when you put those together, you allocate the same amount of risk to each of those portfolios. Over the long term, you get a good outcome.
Ian, that's a quick question. I had this conversation with these two gentlemen before, but I have a philosophical argument sometimes on risk. Risk is supposed to be the chance of losing everything where volatility is going up and down. So
so in this context, I'm using risk in the context of volatility rather than in the context of pure capital loss. Capital loss is a possibility across any strategy that you adopt, you have to understand. But this has similar properties to other strategies that you would have on the capital loss dimension.
Okay.
So throughout this, the risk parity, the thing we're making equal, the thing we're parityizing, is volatility rather than any other sort of dimension of risk. So if we turn to page 7, this is just, you've seen these pages before many times, I know. On the left-hand side of the page, you have a standard plan. Where is the capital allocated? The capital allocated 55% to equity, 35% to fixed income, 10% to real assets. Kind of, you know, motherhood and apple pie. And then, as we all know, on the right-hand side, what that actually means in terms of where you're getting exposure to volatility, where you're getting exposure to risk from that allocation. Equities are more volatile or more risky than the other asset classes involved, and therefore that 55% capital allocation turns into an 85% risk allocation. The fixed income component drops to 3%, so you have a negligible risk exposure to fixed income, even though you're holding it as a diversifier against this equity risk. And then your real asset portfolio stays about the same in both ways of looking at things. So you build a portfolio saying, I want a chunk of equity and I want something that's going to diversify it. But then when you look at the actual risk behavior of those asset classes, diversify it as a much smaller risk proportion in the portfolio. That's the standard way most people do most things most of the time. Risk parity on page 8 says, well, let's change that up a little, and there's very few people who do this other than as a component of the portfolio. So this is an allocation within the portfolio, not the whole plan. And risk parity just turns that on its side and says, let's make it so that the bars on the right are the things that we're making equal, rather than the bars on the left, that we're getting equal exposure to the risk sources. What does that mean? That means getting a big chunk of exposure to fixed income relative to the previous iteration. Now, the problem with that, of course, is fixed income has a lower expected return. And so if you do this and you don't use leverage to get that exposure, and we'll talk about the use of futures to do that, then what this would do without a leverage strategy is it would produce a much lower total expected return from the portfolio. So what a risk parity approach does is uses the leverage to increase the exposure to the fixed income components of the portfolio while maintaining an expected return level that's sort of comparable to what you would expect elsewhere. Is everyone with me so far? Any key questions? Good. So let's talk about leverage and futures, because that's really the key component of this story, is getting comfortable with leverage. And although I sit on this side of the table most of the time, I do sit on that side of the table on three different little boards. And I'm well aware from that experience that leverage feels different no matter how many times you talk about it from this side of the table. It feels different from that side of the table than it does from this side of the table. So let's talk about that leverage. The basic idea on page 10, what you are doing is you are building that unlevered risk parity portfolio. Imagine we just bought cash bonds and cash equities, where we recognize that's efficient in terms of your risk exposures, right? It gets you to a nice risk outcome, but the return element wouldn't be effective. And then you're using leverage to bring that return level up to where you want to be. You get benefits from better risk diversification in the portfolio, and you use the leverage to allow your return component to come up where you want to be. And one of the key questions about the risk judgment is, what level of volatility do you want to target? You'll often hear it's a 10-vol fund, it's an 8-vol fund, it's a 12-vol fund. That's talking about how much volatility you want in the risk parity portfolio, and surprise, surprise, there will be a relationship between volatility and amount of leverage that you're talking about as well.
Is Verus measuring the volatility of these when you give those numbers?
So yes, and there's a variety of different solutions out there. If we are looking at analyzing portfolios, we use BARA and a variety of other tools to allow us to understand the volatility. Part of the thing, if you move on to product selection, is understanding how the manager deals with the changing volatility environment. Because one of the most important elements of being a risk parity manager is the how do you cope with downturns, how do you put risk on and put risk off, and so on and so forth. So yes, we can get insight into that, but when you talk about possible solutions you might use, that's one of the areas that we typically in that conversation spend the most time to understand how they manage that volatility, because it's not...
So when you say like eightfold, tenfold, who's giving you that number? Is it ultimately Verus or...
No, that comes from the manager. The manager will have a product they call an eightfold product or a tenfold product, and you will usually... You know, you put it into BARA and you can say, oh yeah, that looks like it's going to hover around the 8 or the 10, okay, given the structure. And then you look back through the past and say, yeah, that was approximately an 8 vol or a 10 vol or a 12 vol kind of delivery. Like most things, you know, your expectation going in, you know, the outcome always wavers a bit, right? But it's kind of the level of risk you're taking at the portfolio level.
I think from what I've seen, it's kind of a target plus or minus 2.
Yeah.
So
okay,
if they say it's a 10 vol, it's exactly probably between 8 and 12. Through most
advisors. Okay. So it's a sort of a check and balance you're doing on it?
Yeah.
And you'll see that too in your performance reports, because we have the risk metrics in there that as, and we can see that today for any of our strategies, that there is a standard deviation column and buried in there. I can highlight it next time we go through it, but you'll see what that is for each strategy. You would see the same thing here.
And also that reads through to any other asset class you've got exposure to. So you will have a roughly expected volatility, and are we buying a public equity manager, and do we want a guy that's trying to shoot the lights out and is, you know, taking on more volatility or less volatility? It's a common currency across all portfolios. So if we turn to page 11, really the thing that's most important to come away from this conversation with, I think, is really this that first line on page 11, which is risk parity has leverage, but lots of other things that we do and that we're exposed to in portfolios have leverage too. Public equity has got leverage. The companies you buy issue debt in the marketplace, so there's leverage in there. Private equity obviously has leverage embedded in those portfolios in a variety of different ways. Real estate, leverage is a huge part of that process of being a real estate fund. Infrastructure, similarly, hedge funds have got leverage and the types of vehicles you use. So leverage is not unique to risk parity, and leverage exists in all kinds of very safe thought of places in the portfolio. The question is, what are you doing? How's it controlled? How's it measured? How's it managed? And what's the point of that leverage? Whether it's in a hedge fund, in a real estate structure, an infrastructure product, or in a risk parity portfolio. What matters is the leverage controlled? Is it non-recourse? What happens if things go badly wrong? And so that's why we talk about the fund structure, commingled fund structure in risk parity, for example, and so on. The point of the leverage is to help us to get this the Sharpe ratio to where we want it to be. The leverage is put in place typically through futures. So page 12, things to think about when thinking about products that are using leverage. What explicit limits and controls are in place to understand the leverage, to measure it, to manage it, to monitor it, to understand what's happening? And that's both at the provider that you're using, and also how are you thinking about it internally at the board level, and staff and consultant and so on and so forth. How do you talk and think about leverage? We'll talk about futures contracts in a minute. Those are the vehicles that are typically used to get the leverage in risk parity. What are the contracts being traded? How liquid are they? Again, that's a conversation about understanding the market in which you're trading. What is the cash? Because you use cash to fund futures positions to get leverage. What is the collateral management component? That we can touch on today. That's one of those conversations that's much more a product-specific conversation when you talk to managers who provide this. How do they deal with collateral management? And then the legal structure and so on and so forth. I read law as a degree and then ran away screaming 30 years ago, so I'm not the guy to talk to about legal structures, but that's an important component as well to understand the legal structures involved. In risk parity, futures are the most efficient and effective way to get the amount of exposure that you want across these marketplaces. The point about risk strategy is it looks complicated. Most of the tools that the managers use are actually very simple tools. They're big exposures to equity and fixed income using very well-traded futures markets. In some ways, it's quite a simple approach, but because the language is different, it's an 8-vol product, that sounds funky, and because you've got leverage embedded in it, it sounds more sophisticated than really the underlying gubbins are. Managing it is complicated if you're the manager, but that's the separate question. So what is a future contract? Futures contract is an agreement to buy and sell on page 13, an underlying asset or index on a specified date, traded in public markets, and the multiple dates are traded, and the daily changes in the index are reflected as gains or losses to the buyer or the seller. So money can flow daily. This isn't something you make a deal today, and then you discover what's going to happen 6 months from now. These things are traded, these things are priced daily, margin moves, and so on and so forth. They're standardized, so each contract is very standard, very public, everything is known. They're traded on a central exchange, they're highly regulated. There's a small initial margin required, and we'll talk about that on the next page. They're marked to market daily. There's big liquidity there, so it's very liquid markets, particularly the types of products that are used to build risk parity portfolios. Very low transaction costs relative to other things, they're very widely used for hedging currency and interest rates and commodity prices and so on and so forth. So it's an incredibly liquid market, a very efficient market, a leveraged market, but a very well-regulated one.
It's a zero-sum, right, where two people, one thinks I'm smarter than you and vice versa, right?
Yes, exactly. That's precisely right. It's a bit like talking to a teenager. They always think they're smarter.
I saw a bumper sticker said, hire a teenager while they still know everything.
The bane and delight of my life is my 16-year-old daughter has a cell phone and texts me. So it's nice she still texts me. But, yeah, honey, I'm in a meeting. I'm in a meeting. On page 14, often the nice thing about futures is they're so liquid, they're actually more liquid than the underlying thing that they're based on. So it's a very efficient way of getting exposure to the asset class. The managers roll the futures before expiration, so they hold them for some time, then they sell them on and replace. For obvious reasons, in commodity futures, they don't want to get a whole boatload of oil literally turning up outside their office, so they're not going to take physical delivery. And the roll process is, again, poke a manager on that, but it's none of this is outside the norms of sophistication. And then the contract return is based on the actual return of the asset and the index plus a return on cash. So you have the equation there at the bottom of page 14. The futures contract plus the cash return is based on the asset return plus the income you get minus carrying costs. So it's directly tied to what's going on in the real market. Page 15, proof that we can do second grade math. This is not a complicated mathematical structure. There are no Greek letters on this page at all. Your index level, so let's say it's 1,000 for the S&P, and you have a multiplier, $250, which means the contract value is $250,000, one multiplied by the other. What 5% initial margin? So you have to pay $12,500 into a margin, and then every point the index goes up or down, the value of the contract changes plus or minus $250. So it's a clear, direct relationship. Not the kind of thing you play with for fun, but in the context of a structured investment strategy, a very effective way of getting direct exposure to the marketplace for a very small initial margin. Is that all clear?
I just wanted to highlight, anytime you're making an investment like this, putting $12,500 to work in this example gives you the economic exposure of the $250,000. And that's the leverage that we're talking about right there. It's not about borrowing to invest in S&P 500. It's the futures contract itself creates that multiplier effect. Now, if you had $250,000 and you said, no, I want to actually invest in the S&P 500, great, you can buy an index fund, boom, you're there. If you say, no, I want to hold all but $12,500 in cash, I can put that in the bank and keep that there, so $238,500 sits in the bank, $12,500 goes into the futures contract. Now I have the exposure of what does my cash earn, call it a percent or a percent and a half today, and then what does the S&P 500 do, and that's my total exposure there. So that, I just wanted to pause on that.
Yeah. In the future, in the sort of the generic futures contract, if the value is going south away from where you anticipated, mm-hmm. do you get margin calls to maintain the 5%?
Yes.
So you when it goes, it's...
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So if it starts going down, you want to have that $238,500 in the bank so that you can now make that margin call.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, that that brings risk home.
That's right.
Yeah. And what it does is it translates that into a direct cash flow, for good and for bad. And in these types of portfolios, where you're using it probably in more, you may be using it in more than one place. They may offset and so on. But it means you're not accumulating and getting a sudden shock either.
Yeah, it's kind of like your house mortgage.
Yeah, thank you.
So we also see that most managers do something more than the minimum. So that rather than dealing with daily mark-to-market calls that, hey, you owe us $10, please send it in, they just keep, instead of $12,500, they'll just keep $40,000 there.
Yeah, it's kind of like a balancing account.
So as you can see, the mechanism is a very simple, very clear mechanism for getting this leveraged exposure. But it's got leverage in it. And as you can see here, in this case, you're getting a lot of exposure for a relatively small amount of upfront. And this is the mechanism that we use in a risk parity approach to give you that, go back to those early slides where you have that equal weight between fixed income and equities. You get that by getting, in particular, your fixed income exposure using these vehicles to get a larger unit of risk exposure for the capital you're allocating to the approach.
There's going to be winners and losers. It's just hopefully the winners outweigh the losers for us in the decision making.
Absolutely. So well, the point is, it's a strategy as a whole, and so the goal is to invest in the risk parity strategy and the outcomes of the strategy as a whole, which is the combination of all of the exposures within the strategy, gives you a set of return outcomes. That's the real underlying idea.
And maybe you could just touch on what the total exposure is going to be and kind of where that's coming from instead of a risk parity strategy.
Well, actually, Ed, you've got a number of these in other accounts that you have. Maybe you can talk some real-world experience.
Mm-hmm. So we tend to see up to 250 or 300% leverage.
$40,000.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, it can get pretty sizable. But it has to, because what they're doing, again, trying to reach that parity between the volatility of the equity portfolio and the bond portfolio, they need to lever up the bond portion. So we're giving an example here of the S&P 500. It's typically against U.S. Treasuries where the leverage is being applied, which gives us a little bit more comfort, too, because A, it's a less volatile market, and B, we don't expect Treasuries to ever go to zero.
Right.
In this example, if S&P 500 went to zero, we would be out the $250,000. So again, leverage only—it's only up to the maximum. In that, let's just think about what that would mean if S&P 500 went to zero.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that would be
we'd
bad.
We have other issues. Similarly, with the Treasury market, that's how they do it.
Timmy, are you saying we're suggesting? Are you 5%, which is about a little over $40 million? For us, out of our, $40 million out of $8 billion, is that correct?
We're suggesting a 5% allocation, which would be $400 million.
You missed a zero.
$400 million.
Yeah. There's another zero in there.
Yeah, we forgot a zero. $400 million. So it's $400 million. So if we did something like this and we had $400 million, we would be doing what?
Ah, you're on exactly the right point. So Ed, you want to take that? You know, we have $400 million exposure. When we put it in this, do we suddenly have $1 billion exposure?
Oh, no, we have a $400 million exposure.
We don't, so the leverage doesn't expand beyond that allocation. How we fund that $400 million is what we're talking about here. So I think that's a great point.
It is.
because when we talk about this, you don't want to say there's a $400 million allocation, but $1 billion at risk. Because U.S. trustees would say, wait a minute, I've got two things to think about now. We talked about 400, but there's $1 billion in risk here, so the risk profile of the total fund as a result changes materially.
Yeah.
That's not what's on the table. I want to make that very clear. The $400 million, the leverage stays inside that wrapper.
Okay.
So think about it the same way we think about a value-add real estate fund. A manager comes in here and says, I want to buy this multifamily apartment building, and I'm going to put $10 million down and get a $20 million loan. So there's $30 million in exposure. They have leverage inside the wrapper. Our exposure is a commitment to the wrapper itself. So the $400 million that we commit is the sum total of what's at risk to Sisera. How it's implemented, how that capital is deployed inside that wrapper is what we're talking about here.
So if we were to then look at the portfolio holdings for one of these strategies, the number one position you would see is cash. So it would be, that would be the dominant portion. Then they'd use portions of the cash to go invest in these futures contracts for the bond portfolio, and likely invest in either physical securities, buy stocks, actual stocks, or buy an index of stocks, something like that. And then buy futures in the commodities, because that's how the commodities market works also. So it's a futures position there.
But so the ultimate value is the wrapper, so the ultimate value of the futures investment is $400 million?
Correct.
Essentially, right?
Yes.
Yep. Worst case is, if you bought it, that's what it is. If everything goes wrong,
right?
Yeah, right.
Could be $500 million if all goes great, right?
Right. So, and that $400 million, that's as much as we could lose if everything goes wrong.
Right.
That's such an odd scenario. We'll talk about it in a little bit.
Yeah, and I know it was extreme, but I was just trying to get the concept that's your outer boundary of risk.
No, whenever we talk about leverage, that's what we want to make sure we're talking about. Is it leverage to Sisera, or is it leverage inside the wrapper? And this is leverage inside the wrapper.
How many years has Verus been involved in futures?
Good Lord.
What was the question?
How long has Verus been involved in futures?
How long has Verus been in business?
Yeah.
I mean, you've always done futures, not something new. You're starting to get into
futures. Futures date back quite a long time.
I mean, for your company, though, and your experienced people, they've been doing this for a while.
You know, they're a fundamental piece
just
of the commodities market. So, like that idea of we don't ever want to take delivery of oil kind of thing.
Right.
That's how the commodities markets have traded for 100 years.
Right.
So the idea is, you know, suppliers and providers get together and work out the negotiated price today for something that comes to them 6 months down the line.
Right.
So that's been a well-functioning market for forever. We've had commodities and portfolios probably since day one.
Okay.
But to be clear, we don't personally trade futures as an organization. So we're not implementing futures directly ourselves.
Yeah, and I was wondering what the experience level is for Verus on this.
And what about risk parity for Verus?
Oh, good Lord.
Risk parity is much newer. So conceptually, it's, the idea has been around for decades, but actual implementation, you'll see, I think the managers on our short list of worthy of consideration date back prior to 2008, so you can see what they did then, but not much further than that. And then our experience, I don't know, we'd have to run
about,
a scan on.
I think it's about 5 years, maybe a bit longer.
Probably. I know San Diego went through a thought process with Salient on that whole thing, but that's probably 5 years ago now.
So on page 17, some scenario analysis to help you understand the sort of dynamics of what things would look like in a portfolio. So let's start on page 17 itself. the risk decomposition. Don't look too closely at the names on the bottom. One is AQR, the other is Panagora. The point is less about the specific names on the products, and more about the kind of characteristics that sit side by side. And then you compare them to the global 60-40 portfolio on the right. Is there anything you want to say on this one?
This just slices it a little bit differently. So we're using equity, rates, credit, inflation, and currency, that tiny little font we have down there in the legend, which is the way we do our risk analysis of client portfolios. So we apply that same lens to risk parity portfolios. Again, it really goes back to the three equity, rates, and and commodities is the way they look at their portfolio. So it's just a different lens on that whole thing, but very similar result.
Yeah. And one thing we should point out, which is that the data that was provided to us from the custodian in Panagora included more currency risk than is actually in their portfolio. And they pointed that out to us after this presentation was prepared. So don't take the Panagora currency number as gospel. And that was the data that was provided to us. So we used the data that was provided to us. So
they took more of
that. Exactly. So it's a smaller exposure. So what does that do? Page 18, I'm sure you've seen these kinds of pictures before from us. But this gives you some idea of bad things happening and how 60-40 portfolio and then these two risk parity strategies would have behaved in the period of bad things happening. And one of the reasons we compare this to 60-40 is, Jesus, if you go back to the truth claim behind risk parity, what it's saying this is kind of like the capital market, but balanced on a risk basis rather than a capital basis. So 60-40 is not a bad rule of thumb comparator between that, where you're seeing equity and debt mixed together.
Like, holy shit.
And the key point here is, as you can see, when you look down all of these scenarios, in most of them, you see a relatively close tracking in terms of behavior. It's broadly in similar directions. Often the risk is a little bit attenuated. In one of these instances, the tech crash and the recession, both of the risk parity strategies did markedly better than a global 60-40 portfolio would have done. And in a few others, the oil crisis, it did, both of the risk parities did better. That's because of the commodity exposure. But in most of these bad events, you see one or both of the risk parity strategies doing a little bit better. But, you know, this is 60-40 is not a bad comparator for these tools in risk dimensions. And then when you stress test it on individual sort of structural market events, what happens if the dollar goes up by 20%? What happens if interest rates change by 200 basis points? What happens if equities drop by 20%? What happens if spreads widen? Again, page 19 shows that behavior. So the U.S. dollar moves. I think that this is the anomaly in Panagora because of the currency component, so I'd expect the Panagora and AQR to be more comparable. So dollar goes up 20%, you'd expect that 60-40 portfolio to drop a chunk. You'd expect the risk parity strategies to drop a little bit, somewhat less. Interest rates go up 200 basis points overnight. Where is the leverage in a risk parity strategy? It's associated with fixed income. So you would expect them to do a risk parity, to do worse than a simple 60-40, because that's where the leverage is. Global equities go down 20%. You would expect the 60-40 to do poorly. You'd expect risk parity to do less poorly, and so on.
Just to pause on that, we modeled this based on their standing portfolios. Part of what the manager would say is that you're not capturing the nimbleness that our volatility models will see things like this happen and adjust accordingly. We're trying to say, yeah, what if this happened overnight? So it's kind of a shock to the system where you'll get a chance to react. Then what's happened? And
you would not expect these. I mean, 10% moves in markets are not the kinds of things you expect to happen. So these are bad things happen instantly, outer boundaries. Kind of idea.
Margin call.
That's right.
Very significant margin calls.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, and what Ed said about the process management element is really important. The way the different managers think about the relationships between the asset classes they're investing in, the covariance matrices they build, the way that they manage the risk, the way they dial risk back in more volatile environments. That's where the skill in risk parity management comes in. And when you're talking about implementing strategies, that's one of the areas that it's worth spending time and attention talking and understanding what potential managers you might use. How do they do it? Why do they think it adds value? And they should be able to make robust claims as to why those approaches make sense. Page 20, getting away from the kind of extreme mathematical approach that you have on the previous two pages, where you sudden 20% move in markets, which don't happen very often. What we tried to do is put on one page, on page 20, for these four kind of areas, equity, core bonds, high yield, and risk parity, just some idea of downside exposures, rough scales of them in various events. So in a rising interest rate environment, you'd expect equities probably to be weakish. You'd expect core bonds to be weaker than you'd expect equities. High yield, you're getting a bigger income stream, but you'd expect them to be maybe probably a bit less hit than core. Risk parity, similarly, wouldn't do great, but probably you get protection relative to the core fixed income portfolio. Falling equities, the biggest hit would be in your equity portfolio. Probably core bonds might actually do a bit better. High yield would be dinged a little bit. Risk parity would be dinged a little bit as well because you've got a chunky exposure to the equity market. Higher credit spreads, that would impact high yield most, and risk parity, core, and equity would probably get clipped a little bit too. You get the perfect storm of, I hate that phrase, but still you get the perfect storm of rising interest rates, falling equities, and higher credit spreads. Risk parity is going to have a bad time in that environment. The thesis behind risk parity is that is not a common environment. And you get protection from the bad things happening that are normal to expect, and you get exposure to the underlying return drivers in the major markets in a more efficient fashion. Questions on this page? Does this make sense?
I have a question on page 19. Yeah. On the global credit spreads, plus 100 basis points, what would happen with AQR in that scenario?
Zero.
Okay.
It's not. I don't think it's missing. It's just
it's zero.
In line with the line.
So with the current environment where we're looking at further Fed rate hikes and a market at risk, and I mean, there's all these predictions that at some point there's going to be a crash, and we have the perfect storm. Looks like it's potentially on the horizon. Why at this point would we want to do risk parity if we're facing that?
So, that is the perfect storm. It's an odd situation that you wouldn't expect to last for a long time, that you have these three things happening at the same time. So if you have falling bond prices and falling stock prices and falling credit spreads, by the way, they also invest in commodities, so we'd have to take that into account. That's an odd environment for an extended period of time. It can happen, and in fact, first quarter was much like that. We did see rates rise. We did see equities sell off. Commodities were kind of the saving grace, helped a little bit, but didn't offset what was going on in the equity and bond markets. So it will happen for periods of time. And so when we take a look at these strategies and say, okay, show me what happened in 2008, because here's where we saw some pretty dire results. We did see these three things happening. They outperformed 60-40. So when we get into specific managers and saying, you know, let me see what you did and how did you manage those waters, they navigated them pretty well. That's why we think it's worthy of your consideration. It's that nimbleness component comes into play as well.
So when you talk to them about that experience in 2008, what you hear is, well, we had placed things in place that allowed us to dial the risk back across the places where we were taking risk. So yes, the strategy was in place, but the amount of exposure to risk, we dialed all the way back because we recognized it was a volatile and unattractive environment. So that's where the active management component of what they're doing comes into play.
And I think when we take a look at this in terms of a contributor to the growth portfolio, which is really an equity-centric portfolio, there's no set of bars under the equity column there, but an environment of rising interest rates, falling equities, and higher credit spreads by definition is going to be bad for equities as well. Yeah. But equities still have a role, right? A very significant role of that long-term growth expansion capital. And we're viewing this as a diversifier to equities, but a contributor to that growth portfolio. So yes, that particular environment that we're flagging there is when this one we're going to expect to not be great, but you know, over multiple environments, there's a little bit more nimbleness in these types of strategies. They have more flexibility in how they're deploying across risk exposures. And we would say, okay, we understand where it can go badly. And understanding the last couple of pages have all been big negative numbers, so I don't want to have the trustees get frightened at this point where we're talking about like a corner distribution. If things go badly, what does that look like relative to everything else in the portfolio? When things go right, I think is what we were seeing earlier and probably later in the presentation here.
Sort of a blue sky question. If we were to take 20-year increments, starting each year, going back 100 years, and have a strategy of 100% equities, would there be any period where at the end of each 20-year segment, we wouldn't be ahead?
That's what year you start.
Well, that's the question broadly, and
I think the answer may be no, but if it's not no, it's a very small number, which is why we believe in the equity risk premium. Over the long term, equity risk, we believe, is a compensated risk. The question is what happens over that 20-year period and the volatility you're taking on for that and how you build diversification to balance those downsides.
And our liability is a 50, 60, 70-year liability as contrasted to an endowment fund that's got an obligation each year that is completely tied to return. So I say it was a blue sky question. One strategy to maximize return could be total equity, as long as we're willing to accept the volatility in
there's the key.
In the time frame period.
The reality is
all in.
No, the path dependency matters tremendously. Right. And so going through a trough when the decision makers change over time, the assets change over time, and the health of the plan sponsor changes over time, that path dependency of a big trough is probably, and this is part of what we or Verus did with the board in terms of the enterprise risk tolerance survey. If this was a set an allocation, walk away for 20 years and come back to it, we'd have a very different allocation than what we have today. But we have something that mitigates those downturns in there by definition. So, to your point, can we just accept all that equity risk? Theoretically. Practically speaking, the path matters, the downsides hurt worse than the upsides feel good. And, strategies like this start to seek to truncate those downsides.
And my purpose for sort of posing that is exactly to focus on why we do it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think why we do it makes sense.
Right. Yeah. So question, this may be a dumb question, but would your analysis of this type of investment be different if it's 2010 at the start of an expansion cycle versus 2018 or 19? I mean, we're in what, year 9 of a pretty robust expansion? The mm-hmm. question is, does that give anybody pause in terms of the strategy, knowing that some facet of winter is going to show up at some point, sooner rather than later? You can write that down.
You've got a way with words.
I'll give you the general Verus answer, if that makes sense, and then Ed can maybe give a specific answer. But the general Verus answer is, we would generally not recommend thinking of an allocation to risk parity as a market timing decision. This is a strategic allocation to something that gets you a diversified exposure to a bundle of risks in a different way that we believe adds value at the total portfolio risk-adjusted return level rather than a market timing question.
Yeah, so I meant to preface my question with, I know we can't time the market, but, and then I asked my question, but that's real, acknowledging that you can't time the market. Completely understand, but I'm wondering, since we're in year 9 of an expansion, does that give anybody pause?
So going back and thinking about 2010 is an interesting case, because 2010 there's still just a lot of people who are fearful, and so even though it was the beginning of a nice bull market where we probably all should have invested in more stocks,
many
of us did less investing for a year. And the risk parity managers looked at the environment and their strategy, instead of focusing on all the red arrows of page 20, was actually the other side of things. We have lowering rates, we have an improving economy, we have improving earnings, we have improving stock market, yada, yada, yada. How do we manage in that environment? And the answer was, well, where can we find volatility? Because now we're trying to get to some target number, call it 10 or 12 or whatever the number is, but we're trying to get to there, and everything's complacent. And how do we do that? We have to now invest proportionately more in equities and commodities to get our volatility up to that level. How would that call work out for you? Great, until commodities corrected in 14 or 15, whenever oil fell off. So that caused them a hiccup.
Yeah.
But the equity markets were their saving grace, and so they continued on. Now we're looking at page 20 and saying, so now what would we do? So I love your question, because then it kind of focuses on the other side of what risk parity managers have to deal with. There's the high volatility. Uh-oh. Reduce your equity positions, reduce your commodity positions, increase your bond positions, and manage to that 10 by keeping it down to 10. In the past several years, it's been how do we get it up to 10, and that's how we do it. And as a result, the numbers look pretty good. So they end up, I think what we'll end up showing you in terms of specific managers and their track records and how they're able to compete in that environment. Do they underperform the S&P 500? Yeah. But do they outperform a 60-40? Yeah. So,
yeah. Okay. So let's turn to page 21 if we can, and see what the effect on portfolios is, because we've been kind of looking on the negative side. You know, what bad stuff can happen. This puts that into context. That this is more the case of why you might add risk parity to portfolios. So we've got here a typical pure portfolio on the left-hand column, with no allocation to risk parity, and then incremental 5, 10, and 20%. Allocations to risk parity and how that might be expected to affect return, Sharpe ratio, and drawdown. And so, as you can see across that top row, a typical peer risk, 10.6% volatility, which drops incrementally as you add risk parity into that, you know, down to 10.4, 10.2, 9.9. So, no huge step changes, just chipping away at the total volatility you're experiencing. And look at the Sharpe ratio, you're getting a little bit better return you would expect from that. So your Sharpe ratio increases from 3.4, 3.5, 3.7, 4.0. So again, moving your Sharpe ratio gently in the correct direction. Your forecast return increases a little bit. But then importantly, if you look at your fifth percentile drawdown, goes down from negative 11.2, 11, 10.6, 9.9. So you're bending the results of your portfolio in each of the important dimensions a little bit in the direction that you want to be seeing. Risk parity is like lots of things. Risk parity is not the magic wand that suddenly, you know, changes everything. You're 10 years younger, 30 pounds lighter, and you know your house has doubled in size, and yet heating costs have dropped, right? It's that would be nice, but that's not what it is. But a mild increase in Sharpe ratio, a mild decrease in volatility, a mild decrease in the bad drawdowns, and a mild increase in return for an allocation to a diversified portfolio of risk assets is not a bad inclusion in a general portfolio. And that's really the case that we're talking about.
Do you have similar profile numbers or kind of incremental changes for our plan?
Yes. Page is a handy way of doing that. And then we could probably also go back to past asset allocation studies, where I think we showed some different results.
728. Oh, okay. I'll let you talk.
28 includes the allocation to risk parity?
Correct. So this is what the board looked at back in March, where we talked about reallocating risk parity to the growth portfolio and some other changes. And this was, you know, the direction from the board was pursue the mix two here.
It's always a big question. If you take the 5% out, where do you put it? So.
Yeah.
And then pages 22 and 23, to go back to the main body of the deck, just give you those same sort of bad things happening, and then just modeling your policy with AQR, your policy with Panagora. But again, bear in mind the currency numbers for Panagora are slightly squiffy. Just to give you some understanding of where things might go in both big market events and portfolio stress tests. So the key story here is, as I said, mild incremental improvements at the top line level, using leverage, but using leverage in a controlled, sort of ring-fenced way, using public futures markets in a well-understood fashion, getting exposure to very basic components of the portfolio structure. You're getting exposure to anyway, but in slightly different ways. And slightly improving, hopefully, outcomes over a cycle by getting this slightly diversified approach. So with that, I will roll back from the table because the next slide is next steps.
Indeed. And so, like we said at the outset, I wanted to make sure we had all the Q&A that we would like to entertain. And then there was some initial research staff had done, so I think it would be a case of dumping that off first, and if it makes sense to bring that back then to the August meeting.
Yeah, and so once we have, all questions answered from the trustees and ready to move forward, we did engage in a research project last summer. A quiet period notification was issued, and we just update that body of work and be back in front of the board relatively quickly here. But before we have managers in the room, are there any other questions from trustees?
I don't. Any questions?
Thanks for your time.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.